Thank you very much, Sarah, and thanks to all of you. Some of you have already been to taste and see. Here you can only see. I have nothing to offer you to taste, but we will taste and see the good things of the Lord together as we ponder this question of holiness. The holy. What makes something holy? And what does it mean to encounter holiness in our everyday lives? So, as Sarah was saying, we're going to look at holiness in nature. That will be today, but we'll also, in weeks to come, be looking at holiness through art, holiness through prayer, and holiness through, of all things, politics, which would be about the last place we would think we could expect to encounter the holy. So as we come into our time together this morning, let us pause for a word of prayer. God, we call you holy, and you have asked us to be holy as you are. We live ordinary lives. We do not often think of ourselves as saints, as those sanctified. But through Jesus Christ, this is your calling to us, that we would show forth what is good and beautiful and excellent in your sight. So we ask you to strengthen us for that commission. May we ponder that holiness this morning as we gather as your people. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, as Sarah was saying, I teach theology at Pittsburgh Seminary, now into my 18th year. And over the last decade, I have also become very interested, as some of you know, in Eastern Europe, in Russia, in the Eastern Orthodox world. And so as we have our seminars, I will be drawing upon my knowledge both as a Protestant theologian and as someone who has been deeply moved by my encounters with Eastern Christianity and its understandings of holiness. Holiness is one of those words that you don't often think about or even see outside the Bible. Certainly not a word that we encounter often on the internet or in the newspaper. So maybe to begin with, to try to think about what is it that makes something holy? What is it that we're talking about when we talk about God's holiness or the holiness that God asks us to display in our lives and our world? And here we have to kind of grope, because by definition, holiness is something we can't get our hands on. Holiness refers to what is beyond us, what is transcendent, what is ultimate. But in the early 20th century, there was a German professor of religious studies named Rudolf Otto. Rudolf Otto, O-T-T-O. And Rudolf Otto had an interesting way of thinking about holiness. He had studied the phenomenon of holiness not only in Christianity, but in Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and many other world religions. And he, well, as a German professor, came up with a Latin phrase to describe what is holy. He said, to encounter holiness is to encounter, you ready for your Latin lesson this morning? The mysterium tremendum. The mysterium tremendum. And even if you didn't take Latin in school, you can probably piece together that for Rudolf Otto, the holy, the mysterium tremendum is an encounter with the tremendous mystery. The mysterium tremendum, an encounter with something that makes you shake in your boots, something that fills you with fear and trembling and yet fascination. This is the way Rudolf Otto looked at the phenomenon of holiness, that it's an encounter with this tremendous mystery that both terrifies you and fascinates you. And in the tradition of our Bible, Rudolf Otto pointed to someone like Moses. When Moses stood before the burning bush, Exodus chapter 3. And you remember that story because you've seen the movie, right? But there is this encounter in the wilderness by the great Mount Horeb, or Mount Sinai. And Moses is out pasturing his father-in-law's sheep, and he sees a bush. And the bush is on fire, but is not consumed by the fire. And you remember that at first Moses is fascinated. He wants to come closer to see what this phenomenon is. And in the next moment, he's terrified. Because a voice speaks out of the bush, Moses, you are on holy ground. Remove your sandals. And Moses falls down in worship. Now, that kind of encounter with the mysterium tremendum, such as Moses had, this extraordinary experience, unexpected, out of nowhere. I mean, he's just minding his ordinary business. He's just tending the sheep. He's just doing his everyday work like we do our everyday work. And then quite unexpectedly out of nowhere, this encounter with holiness. That revelation, that self-revelation of God in the burning bush, also has a technical name for theologians, for people who study theology, who study religion, where God appears and people are filled with the mysterium tremendum. This is called a theophany. A theophany, a revelation of Theos, God, the divine. So holiness is often associated with a theophany, with an appearance, a self-revelation of the holiness of God, such as Moses encountered in the burning bush. Well, this is also a phenomenon we find in the New Testament. And it also is associated with a mountain. Often in religions, mountains are places of theophany and encountering the mysterium tremendum. Moses is next to a mountain when he sees the burning bush. And then in the New Testament, there's a story about Jesus leading three of his disciples up on a mountaintop. The story of the Transfiguration. And if you remember that story, it's, again, an ordinary day in the life of Jesus and his disciples, but Jesus takes with him Peter, James, and John, and they walk up this high mountain, and there Jesus is transformed before them. His face becomes glistening with light. His clothes are whiter than white can be bleached. And the disciples fall down in fear and trembling, both fascinated and terrified. The Mysterium Tremendum, a theophany, the holiness of God breaking into the world. Now, those of us from a more Protestant tradition have often thought of holiness in a rather different way, not so much a holiness that appears in mountaintops or burning bushes or self-revelations of the divine in the world around us. But there's also another way of thinking about holiness, and that's the holiness of a person's life, how a person lives. And the New Testament here has many admonitions about growing in holiness, being holy, living a good life, living a moral life. That way of thinking about holiness, that more Protestant way of holiness, is not looking at holiness as some kind of substance or divine transcendence that bursts into the world around us, but is more about the transformation of ourselves. And so as we go through this series, we're going to be thinking about both ways of thinking about holiness, this holiness that is the Mysterium Tremendum, but also the holiness that is the simple and yet profound process of growing in goodness, growing in love, in mercy, in honesty, in compassion. So maybe that's a better way to think about holiness. At least it's an equally important way of thinking about holiness, that holiness is not only the Mysterium Tremendum around us, but it is also the quality of our lives as disciples of Jesus Christ. This morning, as I said, we're going to focus especially on the encounter with holiness in the natural world, in nature, in the creation. Many of us, maybe all of us in this room at one point or another, have seen a beautiful waterfall or ocean or river or some kind of stunning natural beauty that perhaps helped you think about God. Perhaps in some way touched you by the very beauty and magnificence of that scene to sense something of the presence of God. I'm not saying that's the only way that a person might get to know God. It's certainly not the only way that God is at work in our lives. But for many of us, certainly for me, encounters with stunning natural beauty have helped me sense the presence of the holy, the presence of God. And again, this is a phenomenon that we find in many different religions. We find it not only in Christianity, but also in Christianity, that there can be in nature places that overwhelm us with the presence of God. Last night, my wife Deb and I were talking to some friends about the phenomenon in many religions of holy springs. Now, we're just used to turning on the water faucet in the morning or taking our shower, and water is fairly ordinary. But if you've ever been to a place where you saw water gushing out of the side of a hill, there's something marvelous and mysterious and beautiful about seeing a spring at its source. Also, in the Eastern Orthodox world, there is veneration of holy springs. And so while that has not been maybe so common to Protestants and our North American experience, there certainly are Christians who have been drawn to the wonder of a place like a spring or a well or a source of precious, beautiful water. And sometimes those holy mountains or holy springs or lakes become places of pilgrimage where people gather and wander and venerate. So again, because of my many experiences now in places like Russia and the Eastern Orthodox, Eastern Christian part of the world, I'm familiar with this phenomenon of making pilgrimage to beautiful, natural, wondrous sites where people sense the presence and the beauty and the holiness of God. Maybe there are such places that you make pilgrimage to. Maybe there are such places that you've seen and you like to return to, where you have that inkling of the Mysterium Tremendum, that inkling, that glimpse of the holiness of God. Well, in a moment, we're going to look at some slides. We're going to look at some pictures that may help to evoke some of the holiness that can be transmitted to us through the natural world. But one of the things that I think a lot about these days is how are human beings being changed in a world where we are increasingly alienated from the natural world. If for centuries human beings have had an inkling of the divinity and holiness and presence and beauty of God through the natural world, what happens in a world like ours where so much natural beauty is now pushed away, pushed to the margins of our lives? We may still get to take a summer vacation and go to Yellowstone or to Yosemite and for a few moments stand before that tremendous beauty, but, well, I was thinking about this not long ago, how difficult it is where I live in Pittsburgh. I live in the city, not too far from the seminary. And you just don't see stars. Think about how many children grow up today in our cities never seeing the stars. An experience that once was so fundamental to human beings that at night you would walk outside and you'd not only see a star or two, but the array of the Milky Way. And how that filled human beings with wonder and a sense of the glory of God. What happens to a culture? What happens to a civilization where children no longer know how to look up at the sky because there's nothing to see? In fact, I had a really funny experience once with a friend. He has one of these really fancy smartphones, and he had an app on it. And this app, when you pointed the cell phone at the sky, it would show you the constellations. So we're with him, you know, it's a summer afternoon, we're seated in his backyard, and he says, look, you got, he's not looking at the stars, he's looking at the app. And I thought, that's sort of what we've come to, isn't it? We no longer look at the stars, we look at pictures of the stars. We no longer see the constellations, but we can pull up reproductions of those constellations. What happens to a culture when there's no longer the primal experience of something like the stars? Or another example, maybe it's because I'm an introvert, but I've been thinking about silence and how we live in a culture that is rarely silent. We are used to nonstop noise, machines, cars, motorcycles, buses, air conditioners, furnaces. We always have noise around us. How does a culture change? How does a civilization change when people no longer have the experience of the mysterium tremendum of silence? You know, there's actually somebody who's written a book about this. He has gone all over the world trying to find the last quiet places. And he says that there are now very few places in the world where you can hear silence for more than 15 minutes at a stretch. And certainly where I live in Pittsburgh, you won't ever hear it even for 15 minutes at a stretch. But to go out into a forest, to go out into the mountains, out into the desert, and there will be something within 15 minutes, human-produced, machine-produced, that will interrupt the silence. How many jets fly over North America every day? 50,000. There are very few places in North America where you can now go and not hear a jet. It's in the distance. Probably don't even pay any attention to it. But if you're going to be attuned to silence, that silence is increasingly hard to find. I also learned from the man working on this project that one of the quietest places in the United States, obviously, I'm obsessed with this now. I've got to find the last quiet places. But he says it's the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. I don't know why that counts as one of the quietest places left in the United States, but he's actually working with federal authorities and the routing of jets and airplanes. And just like we have museums for beautiful pieces of art and we have symphony halls for orchestras, maybe we'll have a few protected quiet spots where you can hear silence for more than 15 minutes at a stretch. But I get to wondering what it's like if If our children grow up never seeing the stars, and if our children grow up never encountering the mystery of silence, how we're always being stimulated, how we're always being urged on, engaged, sensitized in a way that ultimately desensitizes us. And I wonder what this does for our experience of God. Will we lose some of our capacity to experience the holiness of God if we're no longer able to see the stars? Will we lose some of our capacity to marvel in the wonder, the vastness of God and God's creation if we're always being distracted by cell phones going off and motorcycles going by and lawnmowers and everything else that makes our civilization tick? So it's my question to you, it's my question for us to ponder, our question for reflection this morning. What it might mean to try to nurture, cultivate a sense of beauty in nature that evokes the divine. Because if human beings can create light and noise and distraction, the amazing thing is that human beings can also cultivate beauty. We can also create places like that man who wants to preserve the silence of the Olympic Peninsula, or like those who want to preserve the natural beauty of Yellowstone. But maybe for some of us, it's even tending a garden in our backyard, a place of beauty that can evoke a sense of the presence of God. How in a world of light and noise can we also be cultivators of natural beauty, cultivators of a sense of God's holiness in the natural world around us? So I'd like to show a few slides and then welcome your questions, comments, reflections. There we go. Has anybody been to this place? Sure. It's the desert. It's the wilderness. Pretty bleak. Pretty dramatic. This is on the Sinai Peninsula and the monastery of St. Catherine's, the site traditionally at which Moses encountered the burning bush. And what strikes me about this place is how absolutely rugged and threatening to human existence. You can see that the only plants are those watered by the monastery walls. The mountains themselves are unforgiving. But for our Jewish and then Christian forebears, it was places like this where they believed that they encountered the holiness of God, where you could see the stars at night and they were blazing, and where there was silence with no human enterprise to be heard for miles. It was exactly in this rugged, unforgiving place that in Jewish and Christian tradition, Moses encounters the holiness of God. This is an Orthodox icon of the Transfiguration of Jesus. And perhaps we would think differently of the Transfiguration. It would strike us in a new way if we thought that it took place on a mountain like this one. What would it be like to climb up to the top of a mountain in Sinai and to experience Christ transfigured before our eyes? In the foreground, you can see the three disciples, Peter, James, and John, and that combination of fear and fascination. Two of the disciples have been overcome by utter terror. They've turned away. They're bending over. They're looking at the ground. But the third one still has a little bit of fascination. Looks up. Which disciple must that be? Isn't it always Peter who's kind of pushing the envelope? My guess is that's Peter, who looks up with both fear and fascination. In the New Testament account of the Transfiguration, as Jesus is glorified before their eyes, two other figures appear, Moses and Elijah, both of whom also had experienced theophanies, had experienced the mysterium tremendum. So, on the mountaintop, Jesus is changed before their eyes. There is the glory of God in our midst. Any of you been to the Great Prismatic Spring at Yellowstone? Maybe you are familiar with this scene. For me, one of the most gorgeous places on earth. My family and I were out there 4 or 5 years ago, and you could stand right at the edge of the spring and just lose yourself in the play of color and steam, the refraction of the light. For me, it's impossible to stand in such a place and not have some sense that there's a world beyond me, that there's another reality, that there's a spiritual reality that is around me all the time, if only I could see it and sense it and be open to it. And yet this is only a fleeting moment. I'm a Yellowstone tourist. I get out of my car, I walk around it for 10 minutes, and head on to the next scene. But the importance of having these kinds of encounters that open us through beauty to a world beyond us. We're going to talk more about arts in a couple of weeks, but of course there are many artists who have tried to capture the holiness of God, the beauty, the glory of God with us through their artistic productions. This very famous painting, it's actually one of a series of paintings called The Peaceable Kingdom. The Peaceable Kingdom by Edward Hicks. And part of what Hicks is displaying is the peace, the justice, the right ordering of the world as God's kingdom. So the prophecy from Isaiah is fulfilled about the lamb and the leopard lying down together. We see in the background Native Americans and Europeans. We see children playing with the wild animals. We see the domestic animals and the animals of the forest and the jungle. And we're filled with wonder. What if this were the world that we could see around us all of the time? Or last year when we lived in New Jersey, my wife and I got to know the paintings of an American artist named George Innes. George Innes. And Innes believed that the natural world was filled with the glory of God. It wasn't just an extraordinary place like Yellowstone or an extraordinary mountaintop like Sinai, but that if we could be sensitized, we could be aware of the glory of God in all of creation and all of nature. And so George Innes tries to capture that sense of the glory of God in the New Jersey landscape of the early 20th century. Here's a nighttime scene, a full moon, winter, a lonely wanderer through the night, perhaps on his way back to his home. But Innes tries to capture the glory, the beauty, the sense of God's presence in that extraordinary moment. Or another one of his paintings, again, just filled with light and color and this sense that the Mysterium Tremendum is close to us all the time. The painter George Innes. This is what most of us rarely see anymore. A Milky Way. Stars that are so many that you can't count them. As God once said to Abraham, your descendants will be more than the stars in the sky. And you can understand that in Pittsburgh, when you look up and see three stars, well, okay, I can figure out you'd have more descendants than that. But this is what the Bible was referring to, the magnificence of a nighttime sky. What if we still, on a regular basis, had this kind of experience of the glory of nature? And how might that open us to the holiness of God? And then finally, this photograph of the Alps, Switzerland, meadows, something that we take to be very beautiful, something that we take to be part of the natural world, something that is actually under historic preservation in Switzerland. What's very interesting about the Swiss alpine meadow is that it's actually, we could say, artificial. This is a human creation. These meadows were not there originally. The alpine meadow developed over the centuries as you had these entrepreneurial farmers who went higher and higher up into the Alps with their cattle. They cleared the forests. They allowed their cattle to graze. And a special, unique ecosystem arose. And yet, it's so beautiful. Something would be lost to the human spirit without the beauty of an alpine meadow. This is my point about how human beings can destroy natural beauty and can be indifferent to the glories of the natural world, but we can also turn around and cultivate it. This is actually a cultivation of natural beauty. This is a garden on a mass scale. And I think the challenge to us today in a world where there is so much light, so much noise, so much distraction, is to rededicate ourselves to being those cultivators of natural beauty, even as in the Swiss Alpine meadow. Right, so let me pause there and welcome your questions, your reflections about where you have encountered the holiness of God in the natural world. Do you have your favorite places, your holy springs, your holy mountaintops?
As soon as you started to speak, I thought about, I grew up on a farm in Somerset County, and my parents no longer own that farm. And I know the people that purchased the farm, and they graciously allow me to come back every summer and just walk it.
Oh, how nice.
And as a child, there were some springs that I really got a kick out of because there were animals there.
Yeah. Yeah, your holy ground. Yeah, where you still know where the places that you knew as a kid and filled you with wonder and delight. And yeah, you know, children really resonate to those places, don't they? But I think even this is changing for our children. You know, when I was growing up, I used to just take off on my bicycle. I'd find vacant lots, I'd find, you know, places where I could wander and hike. And my children haven't grown up that way. My children are much more, they've stayed much closer to home, and they have been much more surrounded by technology. How do they get together with their friends? They text. They don't go out on bicycles together. I mean, I'm not saying it's, you know, still those are important relationships. I'm not in any way depreciating the relationships, but just strikes me how different it is that increasingly our children grow up surrounded by technology rather than going out and finding the old springs and forests and...
It's interesting to me that I'm a teacher. I teach middle school and high school, and I too am an introvert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that I can just let it all go and
right.
Find my spirit.
Right. Right. Thank you. Thank you. Yes?
I was in Florida this winter on the ocean, and my daughter had just received news that her good friend had stage 4 brain cancer. And so we were very sad. And I suddenly looked out the window, and there was a complete rainbow just coming right out of the ocean. In fact, there were triple rainbows. And it was just such a message of hope and promise.
How wonderful.
I'll never forget that.
Yes, yes, indeed.
It was glorious.
Glorious. Glorious to see a full rainbow and three all at once. We get glimpses of such moments, but they're rare, aren't they? Yes?
I understand what you're saying, and I can't come up with a place, but I think the closeness to God comes to in having a baby.
Right.
And that, I think that
Yes, yes, thank you. I mean, if we were to think of something that's truly mysterium tremendum, a moment of great anguish and fear and yet fascination and hope and all the emotions ranging from terror to delight, what a wonderful example. Yeah. Childbearing and being in, as a father, being in the presence of that is tremendously moving. And
parenting, I mean, you know,
yeah.
Men and women together.
Right, and the I mean, there's those moments where you just sense the mystery and giftedness of human life. Yeah. Yeah.
I actually had an interesting thing about it is that it was like lifting the veils.
Hmm.
I could see, and then the veil went back. And I can't remember. The thing about it, I can remember the feelings, but when I saw it, it was so beyond anything that any description. But the thing is that I can't remember it. It was so great. So, but now, my sense is that this is everywhere.
Yeah.
In everything.
Yeah.
And trying to be aware of it is part of what life is about.
Right.
So,
right.
So that in nature, all through nature, all through everything, all through us, everything, without exception, this is sacred, holy.
Yeah.
But that experience. I guess the reason I'm mentioning it is because you can't describe it,
mm-hmm.
and you can't even remember it.
Mm-hmm.
How could you carry that in your memory? So it was like the veil went up and then went down.
Yeah, what an amazing experience! And but I really like what you're saying too about how when we have those glimpses of something beyond. That if we knew how to see, it would be all around us. Yeah. Yeah. That's true, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, the mystery, you can't live with burning bushes 24/7. Yeah.
You can only get so much in this life.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you remember what it was like, even though you can't remember what it looked like.
Right. Right, right, right. Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's beautifully said. And again, I don't really know because I don't know how our world is changing today, but for so many centuries, these primal experiences of the stars, of utter silence, of glorious natural beauty have helped to awaken those experiences, have helped to make us more sensitive to the moments where we encounter God with us.
Well, when God said you're on holy ground, all ground is holy.
Yeah, if we could pay attention, if our eyes were open. Yeah, yeah. Ted, yeah.
I'm with you on the silence. I noticed it maybe 3 days of the year here in Pittsburgh where, you know, Christmas Day, July 4th, Labor Day, surprisingly, in the morning, quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's striking. And when I go to another place, whether it's out, you know, on hike, or when we go to visit our son, we notice how much quiet it is, and how much of a sense of peace you get from that quiet.
Yeah. Yeah. I think human beings need these experiences, and I think not only introverts need these experiences, because actually these are experiences, the experience of the stars, the experience of silence, actually are experiences that sensitize you, make you aware again of just how much the natural world is filled with energy and the presence of God. So I worry, as I say, so much that today desensitizes us, makes it more difficult. And I wonder what this is going to mean long term for the church. If religious experience has always grown out of these experiences of natural glory, if we lose that natural glory, will we also have lost something that is central to Christian faith? I don't think we know yet. So I raise it as a question, not as a declaration. There's still an awful lot we don't know about human lives and how we're going to evolve.